On your way to coastal studies for a day's work?
Yeah, a half day's work. But
nice.
Yes.
That's bird count numbers?
Oh, yeah. I heard that they were really, really high species count.
Super high count. Yes. Yeah. So that's obviously the word is out.
Yes.
I talked to Dave Erickson for tonight. In fact, I let him go on for like 6 minutes because it's that time of year when there's nobody in their offices to talk to you for things. And also because it's super fun and interesting to talk to someone who's really into whatever it is the subject is. Which brings me to you, Katie Gavanis.
So, nice segue.
I just pretend it's live all the time. So welcome back. Can you give a brief encapsulation? You were on the Fedorov.
Mm-hmm.
You started in Norway.
Yes. Well, we started above the Arctic Circle, and then we went north and east. So the farthest north we got was about 86 degrees north, and we were bouncing around between 100 and 135 degrees east, it would be. So basically, I was calculating it, and when I left Homer, I sort of went two-thirds to three-quarters around the kind of Arctic Circle or sub-Arctic Circle and almost made it back to Alaska.
And did you came out of Norway as well. You came and went from the same place.
Yeah.
And the expedition continues. The project continues, right?
Yeah. So we, on the Fedorov, we were there to kind of help get the Polar Stern situated in the sea ice to bring some additional supplies and people that were exchanged because some of the people that needed to be there for the setup didn't need to be there for the ongoing research. And so we were kind of a transit vessel in that way. And then the big project that we were working on was setting up a distributed network of sensors and equipment around the Polar Stern, going out about 30 to 40 miles in all directions from it so that they would have the really in-depth information from all of the research that's happening based on the Polar Stern and the ice flow around it, but then kind of expanding out from there to see how is that representative of some of the other things that are happening, or are they really on just kind of a sort of very extraordinary piece of the Arctic?
And so you're not dropping buoys, you're dropping mechanisms embedded in the ice.
Yeah, so a lot of them involve drilling through the sea ice with these massive drills that are huge and sharp and kind of scary.
Did you get any in on the drilling?
I didn't, not with the really big drills. I did do a little bit with the smaller drills for kind of securing different equipment in place. But no, the big ones were operated by some people who are like, that's what they do is they install sensors on sea ice and in the ocean. But, you know, that's their life's work is sort of buoy engineers, basically. And so many of them are designed to be kind of installed through the sea ice. And then if they're oceanographic buoys, as the sea ice melts or breaks around them, they float. And so there's a possibility for recovering them at the end of the expedition. The ones that I was working most on were with the atmospheric team. And it was this big, it looked kind of like a sleigh with all this equipment mounted on it. And there were multiple different, you know, temperature, humidity, wind and three dimensions, the flux of carbon dioxide and water vapor up and down from the sea ice into the atmosphere, all of these things kind of attached to a sled with runners so you could push it into position on the sea ice or you could drag it with a snow machine into place. And then that's where we had to do a little bit of drilling to fasten it onto the sea ice so it didn't blow away in a big snowstorm. And that was the piece of equipment that I was helping out the most with. I kind of was working with the atmospheric team and got to observe them and help out where they needed an extra hand. So that was a really cool experience.
And so it's sending information, atmospheric conditions, water speed or flow, ice, you say it.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the amazing things about Mosaic is that they're really looking at pretty much everything you could think of in the central Arctic Ocean. So there's different research that's being done on oceanographic conditions, then the boundary between the ocean and the ice, ice conditions, snow conditions, the boundary between the atmosphere and the snow or ice, and then the atmospheric conditions, as well as the biology, the things that live on the sea ice, in the water column, and how that changes season to season. And so there's a massive number of people involved in this, and equipment is coming from different universities and research institutions. And each piece of equipment kind of has its own way of sending data back. So some of the data is actually live. You could go to like the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. You could go there and see data that they've got coming in from their ice tethered profiler that is in the Central Arctic Ocean right now. Other data gets sort of sent via radio or Iridium network, so the satellite network, to the polar stern. And then the researchers there kind of bring it back when they come back. So they're rotating through every 3 months or 2.5 months. And actually right now, the researchers who were there for the first leg are almost back to Norway. So they did a crew shift about a week ago. And so there's some pretty precious data that's on hard drives coming back with them that hasn't been, you know, seen from it by anyone outside of those who were on the polar stern. So a lot of the atmospheric data and a lot of the biology data and sort of geology or chemistry, the biogeochemistry stuff, will be coming out with them, which is pretty cool.
At Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, you're an education coordinator. You're figuring out how to give information to all the kids I know. And you were also there looking at different ways to share information. And did you come to any conclusions or make a list of things to bring back?
Yeah, so I definitely have a list of things to bring back. One of the really fun things was, you know, you're living together with all of these scientists and graduate students and logistics support people for 6 weeks on the boat. And so there was lots of time to kind of brainstorm and think with them about what, you know, I asked them, what is the one thing you would want a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old to know about the work that you do? And their answers were really cool. And so then building from that, thinking about activities, especially kind of games or kinesthetic activities or experiments that learners could do to kind of get at those core pieces of what is important about researching clouds or what is important about understanding plankton in the Arctic. And so that was really fun just to kind of brainstorm and think with them. So I have a list of activities that I'm developing along those lines.
New games.
Yeah, and I hope to be trying them out with some Homer students here soon. It's kind of my test subjects, so to speak. I guess I shouldn't say that, but kind of, you know, try them out, pilot them with some groups here through Coastal Studies. And then if they go well, or as we make adjustments to them, get them out to more of a national audience. The University of Colorado has a big education effort around this. And so
that was my question, is were you communicating with the other educators?
Yeah. And so that was fun because there was two teachers from Germany, as well as kind of an education coordinator from Germany, a master's student. And then there was Anna Gold, who is at the University of Colorado and with Ceres, and they have overall a big climate change education effort. And then they're very involved in the Mosaic expedition because many of the atmospheric scientists and other scientists involved with Mosaic are also coming from Ceres and the University of Colorado. And so it's been a really cool collaboration to be a part of, and that's one of the reasons that I got to be so involved with the atmospheric side of things, is because of that partnership that they have.
What is it that you wish you had brought that you didn't?
That I was thinking about that as I was walking down here. There's probably many things that I wish I had brought, but one thing I definitely wish that I had brought was more warm weather clothes, I guess. So the boat was generally kept fairly warm. And so things like sandals, but sandals that strap to your feet so you were allowed to wear them in a moving ship, and then shorts and things like that. I think I was not the only one who didn't anticipate that it would be, you know, 70 or 80 degrees on the boat and then 0 degrees or 10 degrees outside. And so there was a lot of trying to figure out, how do I stay cool inside this hot ship, and then how do I stay warm when it's cold out there. And so that's one thing I would have brought more of.
What about, was there anything, were there things that you brought that you never touched, that never came out of your kit?
Yes. I'm trying to think what they would have been. I mean, the other thing is that they equipped us really well with you know, long underwear and things like that. So there are definitely things that I had duplicates of. I brought gloves and they had gloves. And it worked out well because there are lots of different things. So it was nice to have extras. I don't know if I should talk about this on radio, but one thing that I panicked right beforehand, I sort of had heard about this, but then was, you know, wasn't on my packing list. And then I got there and someone said, if you want to be doing workout on the ice, you need a pee bottle. So you're not allowed to pee on the ice. And so I spent one kind of frantic day in Tromsø, Norway, trying to figure out
how that was going to work.
Just what the best way to do a pee bottle was. And I didn't want to buy anything, you know, too much. And it was late in the game to buy anything, any fancy attachments for the pee bottle. So I fashioned something. And then, you know, I don't know if they've been using them with the Polar Stern when they're out there for longer, but we were, one of the requirements when we were out on the ice is that we come back for lunch. So we were only out there for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and then we'd come back in for lunch, except for a few of the key researchers might skip lunch. And then we also were no more than 200 or 300 yards from the ship at any point. So I don't think anyone used their pee bottle. So my pee bottle did not get used. That's one thing that I packed that I didn't have to use.
Well, it makes sense that just like I know climbers who mm-hmm. pack out everything they yep. pack in.
Yeah. Know? And I was curious kind of, I could think of many reasons for that sort of that rule or that ethic. And I was curious to ask some of the more senior scientists who've done a lot of polar research, kind of which is the reason? Is it just basic leave no trace principles and yeah, pack in what you pack out? Is it because it's gross if you're working in the same environment for weeks or months on end to start to encounter yellow snow everywhere? Does it impact the sea ice? Is it potentially contaminating the data you're collecting? Are polar bears curious about the way it smells? Is it so that you can expose less skin? And no one had an answer for me. They were like, yeah, those all are probably part of it. So the pee bottle is important, but we never had to use it. But it does just sort of bring up all of these different considerations when you're doing research in an environment like that. How to, you know, keep the ecosystem as kind of intact and pristine as it can be and take care of yourself and also make sure that you're not shifting the outcome of the data you're collecting. And so that's one, you know, sort of extreme and silly example. But another big one is light. So, you know, right now there's no light in the central Arctic Ocean, except for when there's full moons and clear skies or aurora borealis. But that tends to be at slightly lower latitudes, actually. And so not a lot of light up there. And the researchers who are working with the phytoplankton especially, but also some of the other kind of living organisms and the chemistry and geology and biology of that have to be thinking about the way that their headlamps or their lights might impact those organisms and what they're seeing. And so there's a section on the main ice floe that is red light only. They can't use any white light, and it's farther away from the ship to avoid the lights of the ship. But then you have to start thinking, okay, now how do you keep yourself safe and be aware of where polar bears might be or where cracks in the ice are? And so they've got a really intense setup to be able to make observations without white light while also staying safe out there on the ice.
Did you see any wildlife?
Yeah, so we saw quite a few different birds, which was surprising, actually. They followed us pretty far into the ice. I don't know if our wake was, there's some sea algae that lives on the underside of the ice. And so as we were going through, there's the potential that we were kind of kicking that up and the organisms, the krill and stuff that feed on that ice algae. There's also, I don't know exactly how the Russian ship disposed of food waste as we were going, but we had kind of a following of gulls and other seabirds for a while. And then those sort of trailed off a little bit. And then we really started to see polar bears. And so we saw a number of different polar bears, but there were there was a mom and cub that when we were kind of close to the polar stern, we saw over a period of 2 or 3 days. And they came pretty close to the ship, so it was really an incredible opportunity to see them and watch them, and really enjoyed, you know, just getting to see those animals in their natural habitat and see them, you know, their curiosity and interacting with what was going on around the ship. It ended up, over the long haul, it ended up, they sort of followed the polar stern as it moved up to the ice floe that the polar stern moored at. And then it ended up being more of a challenge because they are such curious animals. And so they spent a lot of time around that ship as they were trying to set up the ice camp. And so there were quite a few days when they ended up bringing everyone off the ice because there were polar bears close by in the area. And eventually, you know, they used lots of tactics to try and kind of scare them away. And eventually those two moved on to something else, but they were around for quite a while, it sounds like, around the polar stern.
And what was the condition of the ship, the Fedorov?
The Fedorov was, you know, I didn't know what to expect when you hear Russian icebreaker. But it was really a quite nice ship. It was definitely, I think 30 years old. So,
oh, pretty new.
Yeah, pretty new. But still, you know, massive steel work ship. And so one of the interesting things about the Fedorov is it's not strictly a research vessel like the Polar Stern is. So it is a transport vessel. It's used for research. It's supported a lot of research in the Arctic and Antarctic, actually. And it's also used just to sort of like help clear channels for other ships to go through. And it's not technically an icebreaker. We found this out after a while on there. So it's an ice-class ship, but icebreakers have a special design that they use to break through the ice. They're designed to kind of go up on the ice and then come down on it. And the Fedorov just uses brute strength.
Just plows through.
So, yeah, it just plows on through. And when we hit really thick ice, it would back up and ram the ice over and over again. On our way out, as we were leaving, you know, at the end of October and very beginning, well, yeah, end of October, the ice was getting thicker in that area. So when we had headed in late September and early October, the ice in most places was very thin. And we had to search really hard, actually, to find a floe thick enough for the polar stern to kind of pull up next to and set up that ice camp, and then to find floes to put the other equipment on that were safe to put people on, and snow machines. And
I remember before you left, when we spoke, you talked about the yellow ice, about the degraded ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it was, did you see a lot of that?
Yeah. So it was, you know, there were definitely some areas with pretty rotten ice. And then there was a lot of there wasn't a lot of ice from multi-year ice. So there were, you know, we found some that were, the ice had sort of just survived the melting season. So when we were there, that was at the ice, sea ice minimum. And so there was some that was just about a year or 13 months old. And then, but there was also a lot that was newly forming while we were there.
And did you need that like 3-year ice in order to embed the polar stern or whatever?
Yeah, so ideally they were looking for ice that was over a meter thick, which is usually going to be 2 or 3 or multi-year ice. What they ended up finding was, they called it the ice fortress, and it's this really interesting flow of ice where they think multiple flows rafted together, and so there's this sort of mini mountain ridge, if you will, kind of running through it that's really thick ice, and then around it is about 1 meter ice. And so that's what they ended up kind of attaching the polar stern to and hoping that it would freeze around it. And that's where they set up the main ice camp. The challenge with that is that because it's such different dimensions, there's some thinner ice and some really thick ice, the currents and the wind act differently on different parts of that flow. And so already they've had multiple occasions when there's been bigger storms where it's moved in different directions and the flow has broken apart. And then it's refrozen, but it's refrozen with equipment in different places, and some pieces They just recently had, kind of ironically, their ROV station, so the remotely operated vehicle station, broke off and sort of started to float away, and they had to do a rescue mission so that their ROV did not become too remote. So it's been really dynamic, and on the one hand, I think for the researchers, that's exciting because that's what they went there to study, right? Is what does the Arctic look like under these changing conditions? What happens when the sea ice is thinner and there's less sea ice extent? And how does that impact all of these other systems? And so this is a really incredible opportunity to see firsthand what happens in a winter when there's maybe you're starting with thinner sea ice or you're starting with less extent of sea ice. On the other hand, it makes the research all that more difficult to complete because, you know, on an almost weekly, if not monthly basis, they're having to kind of troubleshoot and maintain and change where power lines go and all these sorts of things on that main ice floe, which really is, I mean, it's almost like a village on the ice. There's so much infrastructure that's been set up.
They've constantly had to change because they were unable to find the kind of multi-year ice that used to be all over the Arctic.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's one of the reasons also why this is a, this expedition is so strongly supported by the ship. That's why the Polar Stern is there, because there have been in the past drift stations, and especially a lot of the Russian research has happened where they put researchers and logistics support crew on the ice for 2 or 3 months at a time, and they, you know, build themselves kind of cabins, and they're there on the ice, and there isn't a support vessel. The vessel that dropped them off leaves, and if they need something, it's possible planes or helicopters could come in, but they, in the past, they've been really kind of self-sufficient for a month or 2 or 3 months, even longer on the ice. But that is no longer a very tenable research operation because the ice conditions are just so dynamic now. And with the thinner ice and just, again, sort of, I mean, when you think about sea ice, there's multiple different ways to quantify it, how thick it is, how much of the ocean it covers, and then where it does cover the ocean, how concentrated is it? Is it kind of all ice and is it all frozen? Or are there, you know, a chunk here and then some open ocean and then another chunk, and all of those really have major kind of ramifications for the way that currents and wind affect the ice, but also the way that the ice affects the atmosphere and the ocean.
And are you'll be maintaining a relationship with the University of Colorado in terms of developing educational materials, and also will you be maintaining a relationship with Mosaic?
Yeah, so I over the next year, I'll be continuing it. While I was out there, I did some journaling through Polar Trek, which is the program that supported me to go out there, as well as the National Science Foundation. And so I did journaling through them, and I'm going to continue that 2 or 3 times a month, just kind of keeping up with the science of what's going on with Mosaic and how it connects to maybe what's going on back here or in other parts of the country. And I'll continue to work with Ceres as well on their educational curriculum and thinking about how to, again, kind of bring some of the outdoor activities and games and experiments into the curriculum that they're developing. And one of the things that I didn't mention earlier that I'm really interested in is, you know, as an educator with coastal studies, my focus is very much on place-based education. And the Central Arctic Ocean is a place that not many people are ever going to go. And so it's a really interesting challenge to think about how do I take what I experienced and what I learned there and tie it with the places where we all live and work and play. And so thinking about what are the connections between what's happening here in Homer and what's happening there, but what are the connections with what's happening in Seattle or Austin or all of these other places around the country or around the world, and what's going on in the Arctic, because we really are that, you know, we are all connected to the Arctic, and what happens there affects us, and what we do affects the Arctic. And so trying to make those connections across geography and across ecosystems, where are there similarities and where are there differences, and how can people learn about the places and the spaces where they live and use that as a springboard to learn more about the Arctic, or how can people use the Arctic to learn more about their home?
Well, I look forward to what to the materials and the games that come out of it. And also, will there be, will the University of Colorado be publishing a series of things?
Yeah, so I do believe the University of Colorado will be publishing a series of educational materials. They have a website that I'll send it to you, that is all about the Mosaic Expedition. And so it's got the educational materials. It also has some materials that are coming from scientists on the ship, a blog and things like that, and some updates. And I know that they'll be publishing as well on the, you know, research side of things, but that's quite a ways down the road. There's so much data that's being collected. And one of the things that they're really trying to do with Mosaic is, again, kind of link together these coupled systems. So look at questions that are hard to look at individually and really bring people together to think about, how does thinner sea ice affect algal growth under the ice, and how does that affect the amount of sunlight that darker surface might be absorbing, for example. And so there's all of these really fascinating connections, but it's going to take some time. It's going to take a full year to collect the data for that, and then it's going to take quite a bit of time to analyze it and kind of plug through it. So I would think that some of the more interesting research and science papers will be coming out 2 or 3 or 10 or 20 years down the line. But in the short term, there's some really, some nuggets of information that are coming out. There's some cool educational activities that are being developed. And they've got a pretty good, they've done some pretty good work with having media on board as well. So there are some interesting stories. There was an NPR reporter on board, and then also some print media, I guess is what you would call it, some journalists on board the Fedorov when we were out there, and they were writing really interesting pieces and asking really good questions. And so that was what was fun, was that the educators and the journalists, we got to ask some really fun and interesting questions and had 60 or 70 people there around us that could answer them in different ways. And so there's a lot of really fun information out there and good ways to learn more about the Arctic as it is now and what it might be in the future.
How many languages were going on all around you?
Oh, there were a lot of languages. The primary languages that we had at the organizing institute was the Alfred Wegener Institute out of Germany. And so German was a really common language to be spoken. Russian, of course, since we were on a Russian icebreaker and the crew was all Russian. And that was fun. We had a general meeting almost every day just to get updates for all of us associated with the sort of science side of things. And there are two people on board that were involved with both the science and some of the logistics and were Russian. And so they taught us a few words of Russian every day. So that was pretty fun. And then there were probably, in addition to that, there were a number of Chinese researchers on board. So Mandarin was probably the next most commonly spoken language. French, and then quite a few others beyond that. But there weren't a lot of people that spoke, for example, Portuguese or Spanish. And so, it might be one or two people here or there. But the most common ones were definitely German, Russian, and Mandarin.
And did you leave anything on the boat?
Not that I know of.
On the ship, I should say.
I don't think I left anything on the ship. Oh, that's not true. I left a lens cap on the ship. So a lot of the equipment, the research equipment, was stored in the forward hold, which that was funny. Growing up in a fishing community, hold is obviously a term that I'm familiar with, but everyone kept calling it the hole. They said the equipment's in the hole. And it took me a long time to figure out, oh, that's the hold. But the hold was it was huge. It was, probably 50 to 75 feet by 50 to 75 feet by 40 feet tall.
So like
50 feet tall.
The size of the high school gym?
Not quite that big. Let's see, what would it
maybe
be?
Maybe not that tall.
Not that tall and not that...
Half the size of the
Yeah,
gym.
Maybe half the size of the high school gym, or I'm trying to think what it would be most similar to. Yeah, I'll think about that. But okay. it was significant. And it was, there was a 15-meter ladder that you had to climb down to get into the hold. So that's 45, 50 feet. Yes. Yeah, I did that math right. And the ladder was, you know, it was about, it was just this, it was a hole. It was a chute that went down. It was probably 3 feet wide by 3 feet wide and then, you know, 45 feet down. And you had to climb down, and it was dark. But you could see the light at the top where the little hatch opened. And you climbed down, and they, if it was rough out, or if the ship was moving at all, I guess, they made you kind of put on this climbing harness to climb down every rung. And people were having to go up and down with equipment all the time. And there were all these connexes, so, you know, shipping containers that a lot of the equipment had been brought in on and put in through the hold with a crane. And then the researchers and other folks who were helping out would go down and pull the equipment out and, you know, do whatever they needed to do to get it ready for the next flow that we were setting up on. And it was cold down there. So we're in our, I mean, it wasn't as cold as being out on the ice because it was protected from the wind, but it was pretty cold down there. So we're in these like massive Arctic suits in a climbing harness going up and down. And long story short, I ended up on the way out one time. I lost my lens cap and it just fell. It fell into a hole in the hold. So it's there somewhere. But
never to be seen again.
Never to be seen again. But of all the things to lose, that's a pretty replaceable one.
Well, I've kept you for 30 minutes and I sure appreciate your time. What am I missing?
Well, one thing that, you know, when people have been asking me what it was like, the thing that I keep coming back to that was just so interesting. It was being out on the ice, the sea ice, felt very familiar in some ways because it was sort of like walking, you know, on Beluga Lake, or oftentimes there's snow on it, so it's pretty windswept snow, and it's, you know, like walking in any flat area around here when we actually have snow. And so that felt very familiar, but the really kind of amazing thing about it was that the ice is always moving. And that was something that I kind of knew intellectually, but hadn't thought that much about, because in the Alaska context, so much of it is landfast ice. And so it's kind of attached to the shore, or what you see is attached to the shore, and then it all moves out at once. But in this context, the ice is always moving, and you don't necessarily know it's moving. Unless, for example, you're setting up equipment on the ice that has a GPS on it. And then you look and you realize you've been out on the ice for 2 or 3 hours and the equipment that you've been standing next to and working on for all this time and you haven't moved at all has moved, you know, hundreds of yards, maybe even half a mile in those 2 or 3 hours. So everything is really dynamic and drifting. And that was kind of fascinating, to be in a landscape that in some ways felt very familiar. Like it felt like I could be on cross-country skis at sunset, you know, somewhere around here. But then to have realized that, oh no, this is a very different landscape, and that there's thousands of meters of ocean beneath you as well. So that was fascinating and pretty cool to be able to experience that. And then, you know, all of the other things that we've talked about, the science, the people, and then to be in that place and to experience something that not many people have had the opportunity to experience, and that, you know, with the projections for what's happening with Arctic sea ice, it's not far into the future when something like that won't be possible at all. So it was an incredible privilege to be there, and I'm really working hard to figure out how I can take that opportunity and make it something meaningful for other people as well.
Well, thanks for sharing all your stories, and I look forward to whatever comes from this for you, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.